Hey folks, want to talk a little bit about our sponsor for the coaching staff. Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, all American used cars and trucks. Had to bring my car in just last week, and Juan Carlos and everybody there took great care of me. They've got some great deals for you folks here, and you're going to want to listen carefully to this. If you're in the Omaha area and you need an oil change, you need to go to Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, 4839 North 90th Street here in Omaha. If you go there on Wednesday, it's only $15 for the labor on your oil change. You need to mention a pen and a napkin, but it's only $15 on Wednesdays for the labor for your oil changes. If you need a new set of tires, go to Ruiz Auto. And it is, if you get a set of four tires, they'll take $75 off if you mention a pen and a napkin. And finally, all American used cars and trucks, 144th and I-80 there. If you say a pen and a napkin 2025, if you mention a pen and a napkin 2025, it is $300 off of any used car or truck out at all American used cars and trucks. So if you are in the need of an oil change, if you are in need of a new set of tires, if you are in the need of a nice new to you automobile, you need to go check out Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust. Again, 4839 North 90th Street here in Omaha, or All American Used Cars and Trucks, 144th and I-80 here in Omaha. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of A Pen and a Napkin Podcast, the weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 126. We are going to talk about special teams today, Tony. We're going to talk about blobs and slobs and end-of-game situations. But as I mentioned, before we get to any of that, let's get to the most important thing of the day. Mr. Tony Devis, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. The wind has died down a little bit. Sun was out today. It's amazing what a little bit of that will do to a person's countenance. And so, yeah, doing well. How are things in Omaha? Because you usually get the weather today that we get tomorrow. So how are things today?
Well, first, before we get to the weather in Omaha, you said the sun's out. So the natural follow-up is with you, Tony. Is sun's out, guns out?
The pea shooter's long sleeves from today.
Yes, the sun is out here, and yes, my pea shooters are very carefully covered as well. So it's a nice day, about 60 degrees. I should have gone out and done some yard work, but you know, I had other things that we had to get taken care of here. So including this podcast here, episode 126. Tony, I've got, we've got a couple of really nice running backs here. Saquon Barkley. He had a nice year this year. Did okay. Adrian Peterson, pretty good running back as well.
Wow.
all day, you bet. Rod Woodson, terrific defensive back. Baseballer Andrew McCutchen. Was he a league MVP at one point?
I believe so. With the Pirates.
Oh my God. I've got one basketballer, Tony, tying our two states together. He went to high school in Iowa, went to college in Nebraska.
High school in Iowa, college in Nebraska.
Played the NBA for at least 15 years.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I believe he is in the Atlanta Hawks front office now.
I want to see Danny Ferry, but obviously that's not right because Danny Ferry was not in Iowa and he didn't go to college in Nebraska. Uh-huh. But that's about the only guy I can remember that's an Atlanta Hawks front.
Yeah. His best years in the NBA, Philadelphia 76ers. He was an all-star.
Kyle Korver.
There it is, my friend. Yes, Kyle Korver. Yep. So
he was that sure.
Yeah, yeah. He could put the ball in the basket all right, you know, from a premeditated distance longer than others. So yeah, Kyle Korver. And that was the only significant 20, number 26. Yeah, only one we're talking about. So, but which that gets us to the good stuff right away here, Tony. Tis the season. It was March, now April. Everybody's going to lock in on in-the-game situations, special situations. We actually came up with this last weekend as we were watching games, and kind of what spurred on our topic of discussion here today was the end-of-game out-of-bounds play, which is kind of forgotten to a degree now after last night, but we'll get to that later on, that Houston ran against Purdue to win. It was the Sweet 16 game. And they scored with just a couple of seconds left to go to win the game. And obviously, those are the situations that get the most attention. Those end of games, baseline out of bounds plays, sideline out of bounds plays. But it should be important all the time. A lot of times we poach stuff from other sports. In football, you have offense, defense, and special teams. In basketball, we have offense and defense, and these are our special teams. And for me, Tony, I think I'll kick it off here. This is where your coaching can really, really affect the game. You might not be able to affect the game and your lack of abilities on the offensive end or the defensive end, but you can do some things to close the gap on special teams on both sides of the ball. I know when I took over at Fort Calhoun and we, you know, the kids had struggled, that was one of our big emphases. Not that we didn't emphasize it in my other stops, but boy, we spent a lot of time talking, you know, if we can just take away 6 points a game on defense and find a way to score 6 points a game on offense, that's a net plus 12 just by controlling this. It doesn't take tremendous physical ability, so to speak, to do this. But if we can net 12 points, think of the jump that your team would make if you could turn around 12 points a game just by really concentrating on this. And so, Tony, I think it is an area of the game that you know, every coach should be emphasizing. If you want to make great gains, a lot of times coaches point at, we've got to shoot threes better, we've got to run this offense, we've got to do this. This is an area where you can gain a lot of points per game net in a short amount of time by being an outstanding special teams coach.
Yeah, you know, I go through and I take a look at, you know, things like that. Where can you make things up at? You know, maybe it's, you don't send anybody to the offensive glass and you sprint back in transition and you make them, you know, make 4, 5, 6, 7 passes, whatever it may be. And you, on your end of the court, maybe it's similar. You run the shot clock down to 10 seconds every time, you know, and so you kind of go big picture like that. But this is another one that you can steal some, you know, if you can spend time and figure out what are their go-to out of bounds plays, and you can take away a couple, 2, 3 baskets every game because of the attention to detail. And then you yourself have, you know, success off years. And, you know, there's been a lot of different things I've kind of messed around with through the years with it. I remember one year, you know, the only thing I would yell out is what defense the other team was in, their man, their zone. And then our guy that would inbound would look up at the clock, his teammates would look up at the clock, and they knew what out of bounds play we were going to run based off if it was an odd number, an even number, or zero. We had 3-man offensive out of bounds plays in, we had 3-zone offensive out of bounds plays in, and that's how we ran our plays. We never called them out loud. They were out of the same set. If it was a man, it was out of a box. If it was out of a zone, we were 1-4 flat, and that's how we kind of did it. And so, you know, through the years, we were able to get some distance on that. And then the other thing I'd love to do as well, sideline sets as well. You know, one of the plays that seems to be the rage over the last 5-10 years is hammer. And yeah, we ran what we called side hammer. And so we would inbound it, throw it in, and get into our hammer set. And it was amazing how many times we would get an open look out of that thing. But again, you can't run it every time. You can run it a few times here and there. But yeah, those are so important. And, you know, I look back at coaches that have been fired in football because they missed field goals. They gave up touchdown returns off kickoffs and stuff like that, and they got fired. And so then all of a sudden it's like, wait a second, we need to put some more time in our special teams. And it seems like in basketball at times we're kind of playing catch up with football. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those things where if you put some time in on this thing, it can really, really pay off in a big way.
So I'm fascinated now, Tony. You have never in the third, we've known each other almost 30 years now, I think.
Are you 30 years old?
Huh?
Are you even 30 years old?
Well, according to my birth certificate, you know, maturation wise, I'm about 7 and a half, but
okay. That's what I'm basing off of.
Yeah. Yeah. But you have never told me this about, how you would yell out man or zone,
but it's yell out what defense they're in.
Okay.
And I just, it saved our guys time if I yelled out the defense.
Okay.
So I'm like, they're man. Or I'd yell out their zone. And then you would see all of them look up at the clock and based if it was an odd number, even number, or zero, that's what we would run. And I had the power to overturn it. And Marty, please don't think this is something I came up with. I had a conversation with a guy working camp one time and he shared it. I was like, oh, that's freaking genius.
Yeah.
And we did it. And then I'm going to be honest, I haven't done it very often lately.
Yeah.
Because I haven't had, like, the teams that we did it with had a very high basketball IQ. And I'm not saying our guys the past few years haven't been smart. They just haven't been that smart.
Yeah.
So I would just call it.
Yeah.
But one year it might have been 2 or 3 years. We just ran it based off of what was on the clock. And it worked out perfect. We were in the box set if it was man. So I would yell out it was man. They would hop into their box and then they would look up the number. And based off of whatever was on the clock, that's what we ran. And so teams would never know what out of bounds. I mean, they knew it was out of a box. And don't get me wrong. It wasn't like I was super creative, but it was out of a box and had different actions. And they would never know what we were going to run.
So how did you override it if you wanted to run something else?
If I wanted something different, I would yell, it's man, look at me. And then they would look at me and then I would hold up.
Okay. Okay. So you were like,
and I didn't do it very often. I probably did it less than 5 times the entire year.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
I love it. That's so cool.
I'm hoping to get back to it eventually. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the past 2-3 seasons, maybe 4, we have not been able to do it.
Yeah.
I think some of it, because we've had the shot clock the past 2 or 3 years, their heads were swimming with just the shot clock change. And so now you're going shot clock with out of bounds plays and all that stuff. And I'm hoping as the kids get more and more used to playing with a shot clock, that eventually that will be able to do stuff back with looking at the clock and running it off an odd number, an even number, or zero. It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. It really was.
Yeah. What we did my last year at Fort Calhoun was we went with the second number was our call. So number one, we could say 41, 51, 91, 11, you know, whatever. You know, that type of thing. And so we could disguise that. And I'm just, you know, hollering out, you know, 96, you know, or, you know, 42. And, that type of thing. And that's kind of the way we did it. So I thought I was, and I forget, I got it from somebody. I think it might have been somebody at Snow Valley. But I thought I was being like this ultra creative guy. But now I'm shamed, Tony, because I'm just like, that's so awesome. Like it's such a great concept. It's such a great idea that I love the way that comes together and how you did that. So, coaches, I am really excited to announce this year's lineup for our 5th annual Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. This year's clinic date is Saturday, April the 12th. It's going to take place at Mary R. Queen Gymnasium, located at 3405 South 119th Street here in Omaha. We've got 3 on-court demonstrators. Andy King, the head boys basketball coach at Elkhorn North High School, will get the day started with his clinic on developing your team through 5-on-5 controlled scrimmages. Jody Steyer, my good friend from Iowa State University, the associate head coach at Iowa State with the women's basketball team, is going to talk about individual player development in small group settings. Jamie Smith, the head girls basketball coach at Solon High School in Iowa, one of the best I've ever seen, teach about shooting fundamentals, is going to talk to us about how to put together a great shooting workout for your players. Coach Smith won a state championship last year at the Class 3A level in Iowa. Those are three on-court demonstrators. Then we're going to have three off-court demonstrators. Our lunch keynote speaker is my guy, Raz Vanderloo, the head boys basketball coach at Sioux City East High School. And also, Raz is very involved with USA Basketball. I'm just going to let Raz cook. He's going to talk to us just with a basketball smorgasbord of topics about what Raz wants to talk about that day. Then we're going to have two smaller breakout sessions. Lucas Dollinghouse, the head boys basketball coach at Johnson Brock here in high school, highly successful program. He's also an administrator, and he's going to talk about coaching through an administrator's eyes along with some other things. Our other breakout session is Weekday Wade Coulter, the head girls basketball coach at Gretna East High School, and he's going to talk about building a pressure defensive system. One of the great things about the Pen and a Napkin Clinic is, in addition to our presenters, we also have two designated breakout sessions where you will get the opportunity to discuss various topics with other coaches attending the clinic. These sessions are a great way to pick the brains of your peers at the clinic, and it's one of the most enjoyable points of our annual clinic. And then, hey, after a long day of learning about hoops, it's time to kick back and relax. We're going to have an optional post-clinic social at Wine 121. It's right down the street from Mary R. Queen, about a mile, mile and a half down the road. I want to thank my friend TK, Tom Crable, for opening his doors to the clinic again. It's just $15 per coach for anybody that wants to join us there. Our Pen and a Napkin Clinic is one of the most affordable clinics in America. I mean, it is really, really, really affordable. You're going to get over 7 hours worth of information. That's $60 for a coach. If you're just a singular coach that wants to come up and check it out, it's $60 a coach. If you bring yourself and another coach from your staff, it's $110. Three coaches from your staff, $150. If you bring four or more coaches from your staff, it is only $45 per coach. We've got a sliding scale. It's all about getting better at an affordable price. So if you are interested in signing up for our Pen and a Napkin Clinic, look to the flyer on Twitter and mail it in. You can scan it in. You can do all those different things, or you can DM me on Twitter, or you can email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Registrations are due by Thursday, April the 10th, 2025. Coaches, do not miss out on one of the best coaching clinics in America. So you have your stuff out of the same formation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As did I. How many out-of-bounds plays did you have?
Are you talking this underneath?
Yeah, let's go baseline out-of-bounds plays. Let's talk exclusively baseline out-of-bounds plays, and then we'll get to sideline stuff and go from there.
I for sure would always have three. I had three man, three zone, so I had six total. And then as the season progressed, depending upon the group that we had, you know, because we began to mess around with a variety of things. You know, we put in a last second shot. We put in if there was 1 or 2 seconds on the clock, having to go the full length of the court, so on and so forth. But if it was a team that you could like keep building with, I would put in an additional out of bounds play or two as the season went on, but I would always have at least three.
Mm-hmm. We had 5 to 7, each year, out of the same formation. A couple of things that I really liked to do or tried to do, I wanted to have one or two where we were looking to get a shot directly off the pass from the inbounder. So the play is designed where it's going to go directly from the inbounder to our primary shot. Okay. We also had one or two that would involve a screening action or a rescreen action in some way, shape, or form for our best shooter or shooters. And then the other two or three were just, okay, what can we do here? What are some different things? We'd like to run like some fake handoff actions and different things like that, as setup and different things like that. But I think it's really important, especially in this day and age of huddle. Don't you think, Tony, one of the most important things you can do is make sure that you are running your stuff out of the same formation, because if you don't, teams are going to pick up on it, and by the middle of January, you're probably going to have it's going to be tougher and tougher for you to score off of that set, because teams are just going to have you scouted and they're going to pick up on what you're doing.
With huddle, like you said, that was one of the things, and I think it kind of freaks teams out. Like, first half, they're running offense on my end, right? Like, our defense is on my end. And so when teams go to take the ball out of bounds, a lot of times I'm calling out their out of bounds plays before they even hand the ball to the guy. Mm-hmm. And so I think that kind of freaks them out a little bit, that, oh crap, he knows our stuff. And, it's not a secret. And so when you take a look at that, that's why I think running it, you have to have, I want to say they all have to be out of the same set, but you've got to have at least two or three out of the same set. Like, you might run a 1-4 flat set, you might run a box set, you might run whatever, but you've got to have two or three different plays that you run out of that set. Otherwise, coaches will be calling them out as you get ready to inbound the ball. And that, like I said, I think that kind of freaks kids out a little bit, but it shouldn't, because there are no secrets with huddle anymore. There really isn't. And the more you can hide things and run it the same, I know a lot of times, depending upon teams that we're playing, like John will, at the end of the year, he'll get into our plays out of a different set. And so it might look like he's going to run flex, or it might look like he's going to run something different. And then out of that set, he hops back into what we want to run, but it gives the appearance that we're running something different.
Mm-hmm. You're adding counters as the year goes along, I would assume, Tony.
Yeah. Yep. In fact, with our I know we're talking underneath out of bounds plays, but yep, a lot of times on our side out of bounds plays, I will call side zone counter, or I'll call side man counter. And so, I just call it out. It's the counter to what we're doing. And so we have counters to all of them. And, sometimes the counter is based upon, if you hear them yell switch, we have a counter based off that. And so those are things that are in there as well, just where you give them little wrinkles and stuff based upon how a defense might play something. And, we talk, you and I have talked before, communication, it's early, it's loud, and it's often. Mm-hmm. And so when they call out switch, it's loud, it's early, and the kid knows what to do based off that switch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's easier. Here's my opinion, Tony. Tell me what you think. It's easier to add a counter to an existing play than it is to introduce a whole new play.
100%. Like, on our side zone stuff, what we're trying to get you to do is we're selling what I call like play action to football. So we're selling that we're going one direction and we're coming back the other direction. Mm-hmm. So when we call out side zone counter, what we're simply doing is just keeping the ball the direction that we're going. So rather than put in another side inbounds play that now they've got to remember that as well, now you're in the same setup, it's side zone, so they know where they're supposed to be. And then all you're doing is, rather than coming along the baseline, the direction opposite of where we're pushing the ball toward, you're just going to stay there and we're going to change the screen for it. And it's super, super easy to put in a counter. And like you said, I 100% agree that it's way easier to put in a counter than it is to put an entirely new play in. I mean, I would say it's almost twice as easy to put a counter in than what it is for them to have to remember another sideline set or underneath out of bounds set or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm. I also... And this was harder to do, but where are you at with this, Tony? If possible, if your team, if you feel like you've got a smart team, if you've got enough layers in, can you or would you have a specific baseline out of bounds play just for late game situations? Like, we're not going to run this the first 30 minutes of the game. We're going to, but in the last 2 minutes, hey, we're going to run, thumbs up, fist, whatever. And this is the only time that we run it is in the last 2 minutes. We don't ever run it in the first 30 minutes of the game or the first 31 minutes of the game. That's what we do there. Have you ever done anything like that?
I haven't. I'm going to be honest with you. What I'll do is, as I watch the game progress and say we get them on an out-of-bounds play, and maybe films out there that in certain situations, this is the out of bounds play that we're going to run. I'll do something a little bit different in it where I may slip something. I may do something a little bit different out of it. You know, kind of like we were talking about with the counters earlier, you know, because with us, again, I'm not at the varsity level, I'm sub varsity level. Yeah. So if I was varsity, I might in that situation. But one of the things that you'll see is that sometimes you run across coaches and players who put a lot of time in and they think that they know exactly what you're going to do. And so with that counter, you can get them because they, oh, this is the tendency. This is what they do in this situation all the time. And you can get them off of that. And like you were talking about earlier, I think that works better than, hey, 2 seconds on the clock, this is the out of bounds play we're going to run. Just because I think those situations, you know, because you're not going to see that a ton, but if somebody comes across that in film, I don't know. That was kind of a tough one. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of waffling and talking out of both sides of my mouth on this one. But I think you can get people to fight on tendencies that you do and maybe expose them because of that.
Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. It's just kind of a thought that, again, you have to have a special team to do that. You have to have some special players that are smart enough to realize, hey, we're not running fist unless it's, you know, 38 seconds left and we're down one and we have to have it. You know, that's hard to do. I'm not saying it's easy in any way, shape, or form. So just a thought for coaches out there. You know, as we're pitching stuff around here, that if you have a team that you feel like can handle that. I think it's a great idea.
The exact right thing, and again, that might be something as you go through the year, towards the end of the year, and you get in tournament, maybe something you've saved all along, and maybe you've practiced it a little bit in practice, but you haven't shown it on film yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also tried to, kind of a little bit different from your philosophy, with the three and the three, we did try to have most of our out of bounds plays that could function against man or zone. Like, not everything's going to work perfectly against man. We might get a layup out of this, but against zone, we might have to settle for an 8-footer or something like that. But we still, if we run this correctly, we still should get a pretty good look, you know. So I think if at all possible, try to design the majority of your out of bounds plays so that they can be ran against man to man or zone, especially when you're at that varsity level and you want to, or you're probably going to try to have a little bit deeper playbook than you would like if you know you're at the Kennedy sophomore level or the freshman team level. But I think that should be if you want to have more options, I think that's a good idea to do there.
Yeah, because I mean, it would be, like you said, a little minor adjustment. You know, instead of screening in a player, you're going to be screening in a part of the zone. And so, like you said, rather than maybe a layup out of it, they can screen the screener type thing. Maybe you're going into that short corner area, you're going to get an 8, 10, 12 footer. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, there's little adjustments you can make. And then if you make those adjustments and, hey, this is fist up against zone or this is fist up against man, whatever, then that may lead to you being able to add in more out-of-bounds plays. Because in my situation, like you were mentioning, these three are man only, these three are zone only. Yep. And so, you know, you might be able to, if you can run 7, 8, 9 different ones, but yet little minor tweaks to work against both types of defenses, that may end up being better for you in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Anything else on baseline out of bounds plays, Tony?
I just go back, you know, one of those things. I don't know if I would put a third of practice towards special situations like that. But I think you got to put in, if you want to be good at them, it's like anything, you got to put the time in. You know, if you want to be good at them, and, you know, our philosophy, I know some people's philosophy differs, but our philosophy on baseline out of bounds plays is we want to score.
Yeah.
And I know some are just, let's get the ball in. No, we want to score because we know what the defense is going to look like. We are trying to score on it. I feel like we do a pretty good job. I'm not going to sit here and tell you we bat 1,000 on scoring on every single underneath out of bounds play, but we do score a good percentage of the time. And I take a lot of pride in our team being able to execute in place.
Yeah. And it is a way you can, again, you want to add 6 points on offense, you know, and that's a way that you get it. Because on an average game, what are you going to have? Probably, what, minimum of 10 plays underneath-ish, right around there somewhere, you know?
I would say around that. Yeah, I think that's a fair number to guess there. I remember, you know, one year, it was 100 years ago, but ball got knocked out of bounds. We ran it out of bounds play. They knocked it out of bounds again. We ran another out of bounds play. They knocked it out of bounds again. We ran our three, because again, it's been something I've had throughout the years, three man, three zone. We ran every single man out of bounds play in the first 15, 20 seconds of the game. Like, this is going to go well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all I got. Sorry. That's it. That's all.
I can't do these anymore.
Yeah. No, I think that, yeah, I think that's a great, and I, at one point I did have a bit of a, you know, let's just get it in. But as I became more seasoned and experienced, I saw the need of, hey, we got to be really, really efficient on these. You know, this, we could pick up cheap points here. This would be good for us to pick up, like say, you know, cheap points. That's all you got to do. So, let's jump to sideline out of bounds plays. Tony, kind of what's your overall sideline out of bounds philosophy?
You know, I'm going to be honest with you. I think scoring out of the sideline situation is much, much harder than the underneath situation. It seems like in the underneath, for whatever reason, maybe it's the width is more at play in this one. And the sideline, you know, it's tough to throw it to the weak side of the floor, all the way to the other side of the floor. So I feel like it's a little bit more narrow and they're more difficult. But the one thing I would give you as far as things go is, like, we have situations like early in the game, kind of like on the underneath, we're looking to score. We really, really are. But at the end of the game, in a tight game especially, we may change our formation to where we're just trying to get the ball in because it's really, really hard. Mm-hmm. I feel like to get the ball in a sideline situation late in a tight game, I feel like the percentage, and I don't know what it is, but the percentage of turnover between underneath and sideline, I think sideline is so much higher on the turnover percentage, and you really got to have somebody that you trust to get that ball in. But like I said, in the first probably two, maybe three quarters, it's just a different intensity on the sideline. But all of a sudden you get in the fourth quarter of a tight game, we'll change our line, we'll change our formation to make sure that we get that ball in a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the number one thing that you try to do most of the time on the sideline, I agree with you there, Tony, is, you know, you're just trying to get it in. You're just trying to get it in. Let's not have any live ball turnovers, pick sixes, you know, that type of thing. We had a play, we used to call it movement, and basically we ran somebody through an elevator screen, and it was doggone near impossible to defend. Just now, the weakness of that is we're not trying to score, you know. But you know, we would try to have about three different options on the sideline. One, to get the ball in, like I said. One or two, to hopefully just try to score. And you might only get one or two chances a game to do that. Like, one of the things I would really look for is, how are they playing us on the ball? And if they played off of us, we really tried to... you know, that was just okay. They're going to play it soft here. Let's just get it in and let's maybe run a set off the sideline, you know? But if they were playing tight on the ball, we tried to run a lot of like give and go and give it right back to the inbounder off of those situations. Cause what does the person guarding the ball almost automatically do when you throw a pass? They look to see where the pass is going, right? And you have that split second where if you've got this predetermined cut, you've got a chance to attack the basket. So, and then, you know, we tried to have one, again, kind of for those late game situations. Hey, you know, here's something that maybe we could run off of to if we needed to get a quick 2-point shot or a 3-point shot, you know. But obviously, again, much, much more difficult to score off the sideline out of bounds plays. Is that kind of some of the ways you used to work as well, buddy?
Yeah, I mean, Like I was kind of addressing in a rather rambling sort of way, that's what we would do. I mean, we have our set early on, and a lot of times of like what you were talking about, where are they playing you? And so if they have somebody up on the ball, we're looking to go in the post. Like I'll call out side man, and then if they are one-on-one in the post, depending upon positioning and stuff like that, I'll call out automatic. Now, automatics means we automatically throw it directly into the post. And so depending upon how they're playing that, side man, automatic. And then like we were talking about earlier, I've got counter play based off of that as well. And then as we were addressing the other stuff earlier as well, end of the game, we're lining up four in a row. We've got an inbounder. All four know where they're going. And then depending upon how many times it might get deflected out of bound, if they figure out our pattern, we can adjust where the four are moving to, because it usually is predetermined. And so if we know we have to get the ball in, we'll reset, we'll shuffle it a little bit so that maybe instead of the player cutting into the back court, they come to the front court. The players come to the front court, cuts in the back court. We have a player, that does a little hook cut to the backside. We'll just do a few different things to make sure that they don't figure out what we're doing all the time. Just to kind of shuffle them.
Let's talk end of game, Tony. Let's talk end of game. One of the things that I really adjusted is end of quarter, end of half, end of game. We would work the day before. The last thing we did before every game was work on our, okay, there's 12 seconds left in the quarter. What are we going to do? There's 8 seconds left. There's 4 seconds left. And actually, I really picked up on that after going to one of Coach Finley's practices, the way he kind of did that at the end there. And so that was something that we worked on. It wasn't, our 12-second play was something that was already in our playbook. Our 8-second play was something that was already in our playbook. The 4-second play, you got to go the basically, and we practice going the full distance of the floor, but that was a special play, but we worked on that just in case we needed it. And about once a year, we would need that 4-second play to try and execute and try to get something there at the end of the quarter, end of the half, end of the game. And so that is something that we didn't spend a ton of time on it, but 5 minutes before every game day, we ran everybody through, okay, 12 seconds, 8 seconds, 4 seconds. And that's the way we ended everything as a reminder of this is what we should be doing here. So that's what we did. How about you?
We would similar, like I kind of touched on earlier, I mentioned we ran what was called last second play, and that's when there are approximately 8 to 12 seconds on the clock. And so we would know what we were getting into, the options out of it. And then the other thing we ran was home run. So if we had like 1 or 2 seconds left and we had to go the full length of the court and I would call out home run, they would know. And then based off of is somebody on the ball, is somebody not on the ball, that action was predetermined as well because we had practiced that also. And then another thing that we also got into a little bit too, because I mean, obviously this has been a lot of offensive talk, but let's say that we get to the end of a quarter, end of half, whatever the case may be, and we've only got two team fouls. We're going to foul you a couple times, and so that you don't, because we're pretty structured, as I think most teams are. I mean, like you said, you have a 12-second, a 10-second, an 8-second, 4-second, whatever. We're going to mess with you a little bit. We're going to foul you, and then make you take the ball out of bounds and reset. And we might even do some things at the end of it where we might show you that we're zone and then we hop into man. We might show you that we're man and then we go into zone. So you're calling out, your last second play against whatever, we'll show you a defense and go something different. And so we practice that as well. And like we've talked on here before, through the different episodes that we've done, you can't just do this stuff on the fly. You can't wing this. This is something you need to practice. And I'm not saying to spend a half hour every day on it. That's not what I'm saying. But if you can spend, 10, 12, 15 minutes, pretty consistently on that, especially at the end of the year, it really, really helps out. I mean, I remember one summer we were scrimmaging. We were down three, or no, sorry, we're down two. And I called out last second play, and they left the 3-point option open against it. And our kids ran it to perfection, hit a three at the horn, and we won. And that's just stuff in the summer that we mess around with a little bit from time to time as well. And just showing them the importance of execution.
Yep. How about let's talk really quick here, Tony, about defense and what you're thinking defensively. We tried to be really consistent with that. We didn't want to change a bunch of stuff up. If we were going to go zone against it, we were going to go zone pretty much every time, or you know, man every single time. We guarded sideline out of bounds plays pretty consistently the same way. We were really soft on the ball. I had the person, whoever guarded the inbounder, playing free safety. We were not going to give up your automatic for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, that type of stuff. We played it pretty conservatively, but we were really consistent with what we did and how we did it. You know, stay inside out. You know, if they hit a jump shot, they hit a jump shot, but we're not giving up layups in any of these situations here. That's the way we taught it. And we just tried to stay consistent with everything that we did. Now, we walked through and we would show, hey, when we're in our red defense on their baseline out of bounds plays, these are things that they're looking for. This is what we've got to take away. Here's our motions. Here's our movements here. But it was pretty, you know, if we were red, we were red for most of the season. If we were blue, we were blue. We tried not to change it up game to game, again, just to make it simpler on the kids.
I think that's the big part of it.
I have found through the years when I've tried to be cute, you know, we're probably, I don't know if I would say 90%. It might be 80, 85% man-to-man, and to switch everything. That's what we do. That's what we've kind of hung our hats on. And so I've tried through the years on some different things where I'll put in a counter where we're into a 1-3-1, three-quarter court trap, and just to give them a little bit different look and different things. But I found that when I try to be cute, it's blown up in my face. You know, I'll show them a different defense, and next thing you know, we give up a layup or we give up an open three or whatever. And so I like what you talk about. Hey, we're going to be consistent. We're going to take away the high percentage shot, make them, you know, hit a jump shot, a contested jump shot or whatever. And then we do this a similar thing where we take the person guarding the ball on the side inbounds and we put them down with the post player so that we take away that automatic. I'm like, guys, if you know, I'm not, you know, obviously a doctorate level coach or anything like that. If I can figure it out, other coaches are going to figure it out as well. We don't have to make this harder than what it is. So we make sure that whoever's guarding the inbounder goes down, we double the post. If they run a guy off it to the baseline corner to get us to switch, our guys in front of that, they take it out of there so that we don't have to switch. And then on underneath out of bounds plays, we're man almost every single time. And the guy that's guarding the inbounder is reading his eyes, trying to take away, you know, some of the easies and different things like that. And then depending upon the IQ of the team, if it's a high IQ team and we can do some of those things where, hey, we're going to foul you, get it to 14 fouls, not get you in the bonus or anything like that. We'll mess with you a little bit on that. And if they can handle showing them one defense and going to another, and we practice it, and you can tell as you practice it, oh, that looks pretty good. I think we can do that in a game. But you have to understand that in practice, it's a controlled environment. In a game, it's not a controlled environment, and things are a little bit crazier and bullets are flying a little bit quicker and stuff like that. So you just got to make sure that if they're not executing it almost to perfection in practice, probably not a good idea to take and put that out there in a game.
Folks, if you are looking for a good book, guess what? I have got something for you. Kings of Their Court, Three Teams, One City, and the Greatest Basketball Season in Nebraska High School History is available today on Amazon.com. It is the story of Tim Cannon at Millard North, Josh Ludke at Creighton Prep, and Doug Woodard at Bellevue West, and the three teams that they had during the 2021 season, the chaos that everybody was living through. The story literally picks up with the outbreak of COVID in March of 2020, and it carries through for the next 365 days. Everything that these players, these parents, these coaches that they went through, from COVID quarantines to George Floyd to the politics of the time to just trying to get the season in a somewhat normal fashion with these three teams from this one city that were ranked in the top 25 in the country. Now, think about that. That would be hard to do in a New York and a Los Angeles. We had that here in Omaha, Nebraska. It is a terrific, terrific book. Of course, I'm a little biased because I'm the one that wrote it, but I think that if you're a basketball person or if you like a good sports story, a very amateurish version of Friday Night Lights for basketball, this is the type of story that you're really, really going to enjoy. So go to Amazon.com, go to books, type in Kings of Their Court, and it's going to take you right there to it. It's $19.99 for the paperback, $9.99 for the Kindle version. Folks, check it out. I think it's a really, really great story, and I don't think you're going to regret picking up a copy of Kings of Their Court. Well, Tony, you may not be a doctorate level coach, but can you tell me who is at the doctorate level when it comes to rock and roll?
The Europeans.
You know, every Sunday morning, I listen to this retro Casey Kasem countdown. And this week, it was from this week in 1987. And Europe's The Final Countdown had cracked the top 10. They were at number 8 in this week in 1987, Tony. So
these should be number 1 throughout time.
I also saw somewhere where they had voted The Final Countdown as the second worst song of the 80s. Can you guess which one was the worst song of the 80s, according to this? I don't know if it was a survey or what it would be.
That's a good question. I would say anything by Weird Al, maybe.
No. You know what? I don't agree with number 2, but I agree with number 1. Starships, We Built This City.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so... I endorse that count. I endorse that that poll or whatever. Yeah, exactly. So, Tony, you've got trivia. What do you have for me, my friend?
Marty, I've been watching the men's tournament. I have got a new favorite player. He plays for the Florida Gators. His name is Walter Clayton Jr.
Yes.
Walter recently scored 30 or more in the Elite Eight and in a Final Four game. Can you tell me the last player that scored 30 points in an Elite Eight and a Final Four game?
I believe I can, Mr. Viss. The Hick from French Lick, a guy by the name of Larry Joe Bird.
You are correct.
Yes, and it counts. Yes, a pretty good company to be associated with there.
Yes, I call him the college Steph Curry. He is a fun player to watch. He'll need to have another 30-point game, I believe, if they're going to knock off the ever-tough Houston Cougars tomorrow.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm guessing while Clayton was going off yesterday, Bruce Pearl was looking over from the sideline and said,
"How about that?"
Actually, probably he was saying some other things that we can't have on this PG-13.
The FCC would be a little bit upset on that one.
Yes, exactly.
Did you, speaking of that, did you catch Don Staley today?
Yeah, let's, you want to talk women's first and then we'll get into the men's?
Yeah, let's go that one first since that one's wrapped up and your UConn Huskies have won title number 12.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't necessarily call them my UConn Huskies, but... I would say that if I would have filled, and I'm not saying this just to say it, because if I would have filled out a men's bracket, I would have picked Duke. I am saying it because it's the truth that if I would have filled out a bracket before, I would have picked UConn. And goodness gracious sakes alive, boy, did they dominate this tournament. Yeah, Miss Staley was she was given the one official an earful in the third, and I think it was the fourth quarter. She was really, and I think the official at one point turned around. I think my wife saw it. I think she said something like, "Take a look at the team fouls," and in UConn had like three more team fouls than South Carolina did, or something like that at the time. And And that's, I'm confident that was a lot of frustration boiling over at that point.
Yes, we've all been there before where you're getting it handed to you and you're frustrated with your team, but you've gotten on them enough. And then the next unfortunate one that you go to after that is, you know, the officials who seem to take more than their fair share of grief.
Yeah. And I thought it was pretty good officiating by the gal that kind of basically told her to zip it, you know, go sit down and you know, Staley figured it out. And but yeah, just a really, really impressive run by Connecticut. Now, I mean, they are obviously not bereft of talent. They have, you know, two of the best guards in the country, the best player in the country, and Paige Beckers. But I mean, they are just rolling, absolutely rolling. You know, we've been fortunate. Obviously, Connecticut is in the Big East. Creighton is here in Omaha, and so we've got a chance to see them a couple of times over the years. And I think it was Rebecca Lobo that said it on the telecast, but they get a lot of attention, and rightfully so, for the Taurasis, the Maya Moores, the Stewies. Now Paige Becker, she's going to go on that in that echelon for their offensive skill level. But especially until you see them play live, you don't realize how good they are on the defensive end, how physical they are, but yet they're beating people to the spot, how well they rotate, how well they sit in a stance. Their perimeter kids are always down and just guarding the ball like crazy. They are as good as their offense is. And by all means, like I said, their offense is terrific. They have terrific shot creators, and Gino has gone out and recruited those kids and convinced them to come to Connecticut. But their defense is really, really good. And, you know, kind of my calculus, if I was going to fill out a bracket, you know, they're as good defensively as a South Carolina, as a Texas, but it's their offensive skill level that takes them to that other level. And that's the reason why I would have picked them in that regard. And I thought, you know, they've played South Carolina twice. They've absolutely drilled them by 30 both times. They've held them under 60 both times. And I think that was just perhaps the biggest difference maker, Tony.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things with athletics and basketball specifically is when you get on a roll and the timing of it. You know, there was probably a time during the season I would have said South Carolina was the best team, UCLA was the best team, yeah, USC was the best team, Notre Dame, and then UConn was kind of like, you know, I'm going to say they got off to a slow start, and there's nothing embarrassing getting beat by Tennessee, but they got beat by Tennessee.
Yeah.
And that was a little bit surprising. And then it seemed like from that point on, they really made a loud statement when they went into and beat South Carolina on their home floor. I think that was the first people like, oh, wait a second here. This might be the UConn team. As they get healthy, as they get chemistry, as they get whatever, as they get right, that we thought we might see. Because he said something, Gino did, where, you know, they have a scrimmage and they lost a scrimmage. And he's like, I didn't even know if we're an NCAA tournament team.
Yeah,
you know,
come on,
Beckers is the best player in her grade. Ozzie Fudd coming in was the best player in her grade. And then the Sarah Strong was the best player in her grade. So, I mean, you have three players who are the best player coming in as freshmen in their year.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, but they got it rolling at the right time. And who knew that probably their toughest game in the tournament was a Juju Les Watkins team from USC.
Yeah. And that is that's the great what if. Like, if you're going to be the doubting Thomas of the situation, well, what if Juju Watkins would have been healthy? And you can't deny that. I mean, you honestly can't. But it's part of the game. Injuries are part of the game. And it stinks for Southern Cal. Southern Cal had beat them earlier in the year by two. But it's, you know, Paige Becker's lost a year because of an ACL. You know, you don't get to say what if because of that. You know, how would have that changed the trajectory of things? You know, I'm not going to discredit Connecticut for this national championship because Juju Watkins was hurt. I still think they would have beaten SC. I think that, you know, they were the best team in the country the last month, yeah, to 6 weeks. And that's when it counts the most. That's when it counts the most. So, coaches, are you looking for a way to improve not only your players, but your parents' perspectives on what they should expect when they come to your program at the high school level? Well, A Pen and a Napkin has something for you, your families, your players, your parents, and maybe even yourself as well. Varsity Preparation Academy. The first annual Varsity Preparation Academy is going to take place May 3rd and 4th, 2025, here in Omaha, Nebraska, at Omaha Marion High School. That's at 7400 Military Avenue here in Omaha. This is for girls basketball players grades 6 through 9 going into the 25-26 school year. VPA is all about educating parents and players to prepare themselves for the varsity sports experience, both on and off the floor. I'm taking all the things that I've learned in my career from all the camps that I've gone to, all the camps that I've worked, all the stuff that I've done on my own here, from USA Basketball to Snow Valley to Point Guard College to the stuff that I've done. And we're combining it all into one really, really intense weekend to help these future varsity athletes get ready for the varsity level. We're going to work on skill sessions on the floor. We're going to have many sessions on the floor talking about important things about the, you know, like why coaches substitute, the importance of routine, different things like that. And then we're going to have classroom sessions where we're going to sit down and talk about different things that are going to be important for the development of the player and the parent. We're also going to have a parent meeting to talk to parents about what to expect in the high school experience, what they should be looking for as their child goes through this. So coaches, pass this on to your players, to your parents. I think it's going to be a really, really good deal. It's $175 for the weekend. That's literally less than $10 an hour that they're going to pay to get this great experience, t-shirts, binders for note-taking, all sorts of different things. Meals are going to be provided. We are going to take care of your players and your parents. A Pen and a Napkin is going to be there to help you out. Always done that, and we're going to do this once again on a different wavelength, on a different level, with the first annual Varsity Preparation Academy, May 3rd and 4th, 2025, here in Omaha, Nebraska. How about the men's Final Four, Tony? You know, it's a interesting day yesterday.
It was interesting. You know, the Florida Auburn game, obviously you're dealing with familiarity, with them both being in the SEC. I did not know Todd Golden at one time was on Bruce Pearl's staff. That blew me away. I learned that yesterday. But the familiarity between the two, and I give Florida a lot of credit. That is a team that will not give up. They just keep playing and playing and playing. I mean, I watched the Texas Tech game, and all right, Texas Tech had them dead to rights. I still don't know how they came back and won that game. You know, and then not that the Auburn game wasn't as dire as the Tech game was, but Auburn outplayed them for the majority of that game. Mm-hmm. And again, the cardiac Gators found a way. And then, you know, as perplexed as I am about how Florida came back and beat Texas Tech, I may even be more perplexed by how Houston came back and beat Duke. You know, when J.J. Tuggle, I think it was, reached across and hit the ball and got the technical foul. It's like, oh, man, yeah. Stick a fork in them. They're done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then that call on the free throw line against Cooper Flagg, I don't know if I agree with that one, but at the same time, you know, one of the things I will say, like Florida, until it is a bunch of zeros up in that clock, you better play to the end because Florida and Houston will not quit.
Yeah. If you do this job long enough, you're going to be on both sides of those situations. Now, John Shire and Bruce Pearl, and especially John Shire, it's on the biggest stage. And because it says Duke, everybody's going to pile on and say this, that, or the other thing. And Duke dominated that game for 38 minutes. But it's a 40-minute game. And Houston through grit, toughness, determination, whatever adjective you want to use. They were getting outplayed, but they kept it close enough to where they gave themselves a chance. And that's all you can do. You can hang your head. You can feel bad. You can do this. And I watched that game from start to finish, the Duke-Houston game. And Duke dominated the first 36 minutes. But it was just Houston just refused to go away. And it was hustle plays. It was hitting a timely three. It was crashing the offensive boards. I think they ended up with something like 17 offensive rebounds, which is a big part of their offense. Sometimes their best offense is to miss and go get the offensive rebound. And that gave them a chance to have a chance. And you know, the lesson learned, if you are on the Duke side of things, is you got to keep playing out. You've got to execute for all 40 minutes. You know, we talked about end of game situations for the bulk of our conversation here. You've got to finish off those press breaks. You've got to finish off, making your free throws at the end of the game. Those type of things. And they brought up a good point. Both of those teams came in with giant winning streaks. I think Duke came in with a 15-game winning streak, and I think Houston was at 18, now 19, something like that, Tony. But how they came about those winning streaks were drastically different. It's no fault of Duke's that they're usually in a quality conference in the ACC, and the conference was far and away really, really down this year. Houston had to navigate an always very difficult Big 12, and they go on this big run having to figure some things out, and that can kind of catch up with you, Tony. It can catch up with you. It can hurt you, and you've got to create adversity. I'm sure Coach Shire tried to do that as the season went along, but until you get into that game-like adversity, you could try and recreate it in practice or film sessions or different things like that, but until you get in there, it's really, really hard to do. But I personally don't see it as much as Duke lost it. I thought Houston went out and won the game. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, you go back and you take a look at it. Are there things, free throws, inbound execution, whatever, that Duke could have done better? But if you go back and take a look at it, like you said, it was a deal where, I thought Houston's guards did a really good job. But, I think it was, was a Crier that kept him in it, had about half their points for a long period of time. Yeah. And Emmanuel Sharpe showed up late to the party, but he did eventually show up and had a great end to it. And then I give, you just take a look. It was one of those things, I don't know if you saw this on X or not, but I had a feeling that the Houston might get him because there was a picture of the Houston team on there after working out, like they had been in the weight room. Mm-hmm. And like, those are 24, 23, 24, 25-year-old men. And if you go back, Flag could have still been a senior in high school.
Yeah.
Con Knipple, very talented young man, but freshman. And then Malawach, another freshman. And so you had experience and strength against uber talented young guys. And in this situation with Houston, they're not going to go down without a fight. And they kept playing to the end. And I agree with you. Houston won that game more so than Duke lost it.
Yeah. And anybody that's out there that's criticizing John Shire, shut up. In my opinion, shut up. Anybody that's out there that's, saying whatever about Cooper Flagg, shut up. You're an idiot. You are a moron if you're saying that type of stuff. I'm sorry. Cooper Flagg's supposed to be a senior in high school on the biggest stage. Let's see here. He had 27, 7, 4 assists, 2 steals, 3 block shots, and only 1 turnover in 36 minutes. You're a moron if you're criticizing it. Con Knipple played really, really well. Houston went out and won the game. Those were 4 really, really great teams, and now we're down to 2 really, really great teams, which means 2 great teams, no matter what they were going to do, they were going to lose those games. And it just kind of happened to come out in that way. And I think Florida went out and won the game. And I think Houston went out and won the game. So, Tony, who you got for tomorrow night?
I took Florida. We do a family bracket each year. I took Florida, and because of my stubbornness and always wanting to be right, I'm going to stick with the Gators.
Okay. I am going to take the Houston Cougars. I feel a little Austin Powers mojo going, maybe a little bit of a team of destiny. You know, Kelvin Sampson, I don't know if he is in the Basketball Hall of Fame, but he will be. You know, his redemption. There was a really, really great story. I don't know if you got a chance to read it, Tony, on ESPN.com about Sampson and kind of his, you know, he obviously failed miserably at Indiana. He was fired. He was given a show clause of 5 years, I think it was, where he couldn't coach at the NCAA level. And he's come back and he's rebuilt. They showed the first game that he coached at Houston. And I'm not kidding you, Tony. If there was 1,000 people there, I owe you, I'll pay for your mortgage next month, because I don't think there was 1,000 people there at his first home game. People forget, you know, you and I grew up with Phi Slamma Jamma and all that other stuff.
Ty Lewis.
Yeah, exactly. This was not that Houston program. I mean, he literally rebuilt that from the ground up. And elevated that program to where, you know, they got a chance to win a national championship tomorrow night. So we'll see what happens here. So. Tony, who's up in your world this week?
You know, it was one of those deals, Marty, where I was taking a look at this and I saw that the Oklahoma City Thunder had won, went over, I think it was 11-game win streak, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, they got knocked off pretty handily by the Rockets, and the Lakers took them down even more so today. And I'm like, crap, I don't know if I can put the Thunder there. So I'm going to take the team that snapped their streak. I'm going to go with the Rockets. And I think the Rockets are tremendously improved from a season ago. Udoka is a fantastic basketball coach. So I'm going to take the Houston Rockets with moving on up.
They are going to be a fascinating team, both in the short term and the long term, Tony. They've got all these young players. They've already paid Jalen Green some money, or he will be making some money. I think Şengün, if he's not making money, he will be making money, but they gave those guys two big contracts. But they've got a bunch of young guys, and they're going to kind of have to figure it out. Are they going to, you know, I listen to a lot of NBA podcasts, you know, your Bill Simmons, your Brian Windhorst, and that type of stuff. Are they going to consolidate two or three of these guys and chase a Devin Booker, you know, that type of thing? How are they going to replace a Fred VanVleet when his contract runs out? Because, you know, he is really important to what they do. He's the steady guy, but they have had a great year. 50 wins. They're 51-27 right now. Got 4 games left in the regular season. Looks like they're going to be the 2 seed in the Western Conference, which is nothing to sneeze at. You know, now they could be, you know, they could get stuck playing like a healthy Kawhi Leonard and the LA Clippers in the first round of the playoffs. So that's not much of a reward. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so that's not much of a reward, but, you know, it's, unless you're Oklahoma City, that first round battle in the Western Conference is going to be just a dogfight. And there's still a lot of jockeying that needs to happen here. So, but I like that pick, Tony. I really, really like it. That's a good one. So, I'm going to go local, Tony. This one near and dear to the hearts of the Plum family. There's 3 teams that are going to end their season with a championship in men's college basketball. Cal Irvine won one the other night in the NIT. Either Houston or Florida is going to win one tomorrow night. But right before we started taping here today, the Nebraska Cornhuskers won the crown championship in Las Vegas. And you can say what you want to, you know, it's, you know, there were teams in the tournament that were under 500. You end your season with a championship. I don't care who you are. I don't care what level it is. It's important. It creates momentum. It creates pride within your program. It's a culture builder. I'm really happy for Coach Hoiberg and his coaching staff. My son is still close with a few of the guys on the team, including the MVP or what I've heard that they give him the king of the crown or whatever, Juwan Gary. Just some really, really good kids. And, you know, Nebraska had a disappointing end to their regular season. In 2 weeks, they thought they were in the NCAA tournament to where they didn't even get a chance to play in the Big Ten tournament. And they could have hung their heads. They could have done a lot of different things. And they chose to go out and compete. And not just compete, but they stuck to game plans where a lot of teams, I think, came into that tournament just, hey, we're just going to chuck some shots and have some fun here and do this and that. And they chose to do things the right way. And I think that says a lot about the program, about the kids that they have, about their coaching staff, and I'm really, really happy for everybody involved. And I'm really, really happy for kids like Juwan Gary, you know, who is just a friend of my son's and that type of thing. So that's my 1A as to who's up here, but just throwing that out there, Tony. I'll give you a chance to talk about it, Tony.
No, I think it's a great thing. Like you were talking about, it reminded me, you know, like there are teams in college football who really want to get a bowl game because of the extra practices and stuff and how that leads into, you know, maybe a better bowl game or making the college football playoff that next year. And that's kind of how I look at some of this NIT and the college basketball invitational stuff is that. And so, yeah, I'm very, very happy for Fred. You know, also got a nice pickup in the transfer portal getting Price Sanford as well. Yeah. So it's been a good week for your Huskers.
It has been. It has been. To keep the fair and balanced reporting here in the Omaha, Nebraska area, I also want to give a shout out to Ryan Kalkbrenner and Coach Mack and his program. In the days where we don't see the traditional back to the basket post player very often, and Kalkbrenner really expanded his game as he grew. But over the weekend, not only was he selected as the National Defensive Player of the Year, but he also won the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar Award as the best center in college basketball this past season. And when he got to Creighton, I mean, he was just a big guy. I mean, that's what he was. And this is a guy who really busted his butt over 5 years to really, really improve. And he showed that. And he had a terrific season for the Blue Jays. And so I want to also give a shout out locally to Ryan Kalkbrenner and the coaching staff that helped develop him into the player that he is today, where I think he's got a chance to stick in the NBA. If he gets in the right situation, I think he's got a great chance to stick in the league just because of the way that he's put in the time and improved there. So congratulations to Ryan Kalkbrenner as well.
Yeah, I mean, you take a look, Zach Edey has carved out a nice role with the Grizzlies, and you know, I would think Kalkbrenner, and I know somehow Tony, you're being whatever, I don't know if he's that much worse than Zach Edey, and Zach Edey's having a heck of a rookie year. So yeah, I could definitely see that.
Mm-hmm. Who are you down on this week, Tony?
You know, Marty, when we did the started off the year as far as basketball went, we did our NBA preview, and I was about as high on this team as anybody, and that is your Philadelphia 76ers, who have now lost 11 games in a row. And obviously are in serious tanking mode, but not to be outdone, the Utah Jazz, like, hey, we're not losing that number one, the best odds for that number one pick. They've lost 9 in a row. So I'll do a 1A, 1B there.
Yeah. I want to, and yeah, you are right. It's just, it's bad. It's so bad. So, I want to give my who's down on the athletic department at the University of Arizona, Tony. I don't know if you saw this or not. Adia Barnes left Arizona to go to
SMU.
Yeah, for SMU, which, hey, that's her prerogative. That's her choice. I have no idea what her day-to-day life is or what she wants to accomplish. Hey, let it rip. Do what you want to do. What is bizarre about this, I don't know if you saw this, they put out the job advertisement, and it's weird. You know, how, you know, and it read more like a list of, and you and I have been in enough interviews. You walk in and here's a predetermined list of 15 questions that you're going to give. And in the advertisement, they had just like, how do you feel about bylaw 12.9.3E of the NCAA code or whatever? I'm like, what in the world is going on here? It's just weird. It's just weird. And so I'm down on that, Tony. I'm down on weird coaching advertisements.
Interesting, because I was surprised she left Arizona too, because she had him in the finals not that long ago. But then you take a look, SMU is wants to be a power player. I mean, they got the guy that was at USC Andy Enfield had been at Lob City, and so they're going out there and they're getting some really good coaches there. But just a little surprised by that.
Well, they made the playoff in football as well. They went lost at Notre Dame, I think, in the opening round of the playoff, but still made the playoff. You know, could we see a Pony XS 30 for 30 times two in 5 years? Like, what happened here? You know, but you know. No, it's good for them. I think she's a really, really good basketball coach. And, hopefully it's a good move for her. So episode 126 in the books, Tony, anything else on special teams that you want to add here, my friend?
Put some attention to it. Put some time in. If you want to be good at it, it's like anything, you have to put some attention and time in it. But it is a way that if you have a team that, you know, on paper is maybe not as talented as the other team, maybe 8, 10, 12 point difference, you can make it up on that end.
Mm-hmm. Wholeheartedly agreed. I think there's some strategies that you can use. And I think Tony hit the nail on the head. Put in the time. You can't expect, it's just like if you want to be better at ball handling, you got to put the time in. If you want to be better at defense, you got to put it. If you want to win special teams, you've got to emphasize it. You got to emphasize it, put in that time. So we will leave the official podcast on that. This is our last podcast before our coaches clinic here. It's coming up this Saturday. Coaches, I encourage you to sign up. We've got a few more days to get signed up. So please get your registrations in. Give me a heads up. Let me know what's going on with you. Would love to see you at Mary Our Queen Saturday morning. It's going to be a great clinic. We've got some great speakers. And, it's just going to be awesome. So encourage you to get out for it. So, Tony, good luck with the tennis team this week. Get after it here. Do a lot of serving and volleying and all the things that you do there. Get some dubs for the Kennedy Cougars in that regard. So that's it for episode 126. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.